This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 18 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're joined by Dennis from Continuing Mission. How's it going, Dennis?
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. Took over Continuing Mission, with the last episode?
Yes, that's right. The Tommy Kraft interview.
Excellent, excellent. Cool. So how did you get into Star Trek in the first place?
Well, I've always been a Trek fan for pretty much my young childhood. I grew up watching Star Trek in syndication, the original series. I remember I used to run home from school so that I would be home in time to catch Star Trek on Channel 12 on my local station in Oregon. And I just grew up a big fan. Captain Kirk was a hero of mine growing up. And I stayed a fan of Star Trek all through the years. I was a huge fan of the first movie, the motion picture. I love that film. I remember sitting in the cinema just watching that great sequence of the Enterprise in the docking structure there and just loving it. And for me, it was over too soon. I know everybody complains about it being too long, but when it was over, I wanted more shots of the Enterprise. But then I went to college and I kind of fell out of Trek fandom and got involved in other things. And only recently did I discover Trek FM, and all my fandom just came back like this big wave. And I'm big into it now.
Excellent, excellent. So what draws you to Continuing Mission? You know, what is it that appeals to you about fan films and whatnot?
Well, I work in the entertainment business here in Los Angeles. All my life, I've had a dream about making movies and working in television. And it was only after a second career, I decided I'm going to go back to college. And I'm going to get a graduate degree and learn how to make films. And so I got into USC, the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts. And I got my master's in fine arts in film production there. And today I work in post-production in the television industry here in Los Angeles. So to me, people who want to make fan films, it's very interesting to me. I understand what it's like. When I first caught the filmmaking bug and I went out and I got a Hi-8 camera, that was the big cutting edge of of cameras back when I was getting into it, and I made a karate movie with my friends. You know, we decided that we wanted to make a karate movie, and because we didn't have a lot of people helping us, we decided that we would have our heroes fight ninjas. Because their faces are covered, and we could have the same four guys just die over and over again. So that's how we kind of came up with our story idea. And then we built a story around, well, what do we do if we're going to fight ninjas? Let's come up with a good story. So our story was we have two bike messengers have to deliver a package to the ninja headquarters. And it has to be signed by the ninja masters, but the bike messengers hate that because the ninjas make them fight their way in. That was all the plot we needed to start shooting a bunch of martial arts fights. So excellent. We had a lot of fun with that, and so I understand that there are plenty of Star Trek fans who bring that same kind of enthusiasm to Star Trek, and they're just having a lot of fun getting, you know, putting on the costumes and building the sets and just being there acting on a Star Trek bridge or a Star Trek set is fantastic fun, and I understand what it's like. And that's what attracted me to Continuing Mission, is I kind of want to bring that kind of enthusiasm to everyone who's interested in Trek.
Excellent, excellent. So yeah, like I went to film school too, and you did it the complete opposite of what most people do. Most people go to film school for their, you know, undergraduate degree and then realize that they can't get a job, freak out, and go back to school to study something else that they can make money off of. But you actually made it work, so congrats. Yeah. You're my hero. Yeah. So, But yeah, all right. So hey, we're going to be talking about a indie young, well, at this point in his career, filmmaker today, and that is Justin Lin. Now, as we have mentioned in the past, this is the final arc on Commentary Trek Stars, and when we started this with Gene Roddenberry, we always thought, since, you know, we're going to start with the first creator, we're going to end with whoever is in charge of the ship when we leave, and that person is Justin Lin. Yes, we know that Brian Fuller is, you know, waiting, but, you know, that's the next generation we're talking about. Anyway, Justin Lin, he's the guy. He's the guy who's here right now, and he is directing Star Trek Beyond, the new feature film, which is coming out in July of 2016. So we're going to take a look at his filmography. I was going to say all of the movies he directed, but we're actually skipping over his first movie because it's not really accessible, unfortunately. But this is the movie that put him on the map. This is the first Justin Lin movie, which, well, people have actually seen, I guess. And that is Better Luck Tomorrow. This film came out in 2003. It was made in 2002. It played at festivals and whatnot. It got picked up by MTV, right? And was released in, I think, April of 2003. So, and it's quite different from what we'll see later on in Justin Lin's career, but at the same time, very Justin Lin-ish in general. So John, you want to give kind of a synopsis of this movie?
Yeah, a good suburban kid who is a driven and intelligent guy goes wrong. It gets involved with the wrong people. Things go from bad to worse, and then it gets real serious real quickly. And you know, he finds himself in situations that he can't quite get out of, and you see sort of the ripple effect of this series of bad decisions that the group has made overtake them over time until the inevitable end, where he doesn't know where the future is going to take him.
Yes, it's an interesting, you know, kind of coming of age story. You know, it's like I always kind of think of it like sort of like a high school version of a Scorsese gangster movie or something like that, you know,
which that's a good call.
It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition there. But Dennis, you know, we asked you which Justin Lin movie you wanted to do, essentially, and this is the one that you picked. Was it about Better Luck Tomorrow that, I mean, you've seen it before, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it about it that you know, kind of draws you to it?
Well, the fact that it was his breakout movie and he had to work so hard to get it made kind of attracted me to it at the time. I was just starting off in film school, planning to go to film school, and when I watched this movie. And it reminded me of another filmmaker. It reminded me, and this may sound strange, but it reminded me of George Lucas. Right? They both kind of came to this place where they set their stories in an environment that they knew. Environment they grew up in. And George Lucas with American Graffiti, and Justin Lin did Better Luck Tomorrow. Now, we know that Justin Lin, he knows what it's like to go to high school as an Asian American kid. He went to high school in Orange County, like his characters. And, you know, that helps bring the world of that story to life. It shares something else. Like George Lucas with American Graffiti, Lin is setting this story in a world that he knows. The one of the results of that is that despite his budget of less than $500,000, the world that the characters play in seems perfectly real and natural, and that's not easy to do. A lot of films that have a small budget can feel stagey or fake or artificial, but it clearly shows that he has a grasp, not only as a director, but that he knew his setting well enough that he could bring it to life and make it authentic on a shoestring.
Sure.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah, I think the Lucas, drawing the parallel with that is pretty interesting. And it makes me think, because Mike, you always talk about doing double features of things. It would be interesting to watch American Graffiti and then Better Luck Tomorrow back to back and sort of get that feel for, you know, what does it say about how, you know, the, you know, because Lucas, of course, presents a very idyllic look back at his youth, you know, with the car culture and everything. But is it something where you could almost look at it sociologically as like, what is one film saying about growing up, you know, in small town America? And what is the other film saying about growing up in the modern neighborhood and, you know, how people view their future and their way out of everything? Because it's like the characters in this movie are so they're, you know, like one of the things I like most about the movie is that they address head on where Ben has, you know, the voiceover line at one point where he's talking about these bad things that they're doing before things get really, really bad. But he's talking about these sort of criminal things that they're doing. And he's like, you know what? We were, you know, we had the grades. Like, nobody was going to look at us. We were just doing it because there was nothing else to do. And I think that that's a really interesting sort of take on the different mentality between the two movies, regardless of their similarities. I like that you brought that up, Dennis.
Yeah. One thing that you haven't mentioned yet, that we haven't mentioned yet, is the is that this is an Asian American story. This is a modern day story of Asian American experience in America, specifically Southern California, and it's addressing something that wouldn't occur to a lot of us, which is the pressure that these students feel that they're while they're in school. They feel this terrible pressure to always be perfect and to always do what's expected of them, both as sons of their families and as members of the Asian American community. You see that with the basketball sequence where he's on the basketball team, and then they try to, some activists try to put Ben into this kind of place where he's representing all the Asian American students on the basketball team, and he kind of rebels against that and quits the basketball team. So he says, you know, rightly so, you bring that up. He says, our straight A's were our passports to freedom. As long as he was given his parents straight A's, they pretty much gave him carte blanche to do whatever he wanted with the rest of his time. And the way that he kind of relieved that pressure to always be perfect was to rebel against it by being the opposite of perfect and kind of getting involved. That was what attracted him initially, the high that he mm-hmm. got from this kind of the petty crimes that they got involved in, until pretty soon it started just completely getting away from them and getting worse and worse.
Yeah,
that's true. And yeah, I mean, it would, you know, going back to that sort of George Lucas comparison, I mean, it's interesting in that both of these are really sort of about characters at the same point in their lives, even, you know, like school is ending and now they've got to figure out, you know, having that crisis of what do I do now, you know? And it is kind of interesting how the pressures, while, you know, similar in some ways, are different in others, and how they, you know, manifest themselves in these particular stories is pretty interesting. That is kind of a cool comparison. I guess kind of another comparison which you could make, I mean, not just in terms of, you know, American Graffiti, but just in terms of movies in general and the high school movies and that type of thing, is the style, which I think is really, you know, interesting, and kind of speaks to Justin Lin as a filmmaker. You know, we're getting to see this, you know, right off the bat. You know, Lin is a guy who's known for making big budget movies with cars that fly and jump and, you know, all sorts of Vin Diesel all over the place and everything. And, you know, his movies have style to burn. You know, that is definitely true. And I remember when it was first announced that he was doing Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift, I hadn't seen Better Luck Tomorrow at that point, but I knew who he was because, you know, John and I were just talking, you know, off mic about Roger Ebert's love for this movie. You know, he was a huge champion of this film, and, you know, he talked about, you know, this is indie cinema done right, blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, it was definitely something that I was aware of, but you hear things like that and you think, okay, low budget, you know, high school movie, you kind of have this idea in your mind of what this movie is and what it looks like and everything. And then you hear that they're getting that guy to do Fast and the Furious 3, and you're like, where is the... I don't see the correlation between those two things. Yeah. But you watch this movie, and you realize that this is just as stylized as those movies, just on a different scale. What did you guys think about the style in Better Luck Tomorrow?
Well, the style definitely serves the storytelling. It has a little bit of a twist to it, and it shows it's not your... It shows that the characters are kind of outside the mainstream of their the American kind of the standard American outlook on things. It also is it's fun, and it brings a kind of comedic approach. Otherwise, the film would just be a little too heavy and too dark. And one of the things that I've always loved about this movie is that it carries a pretty serious message and a pretty dark tone, and it kind of hides it in this high school comedy. At first, it's like this standard high school comedy where the kind of the kid who wants to be popular, and he's got a crush on the cheerleader, and the cheerleader's going out with the older guy who's, you know, rides a motorcycle, and you know, it's got all these hallmarks of this kind of teen comedy that in the hands of a more commercial or less ambitious director would probably just shoot for laughs, you know, shoot for that kind of low hanging fruit of that teen comedy. But instead, he's got a much more serious message going on there.
Yeah. I think just stylistically, I cannot yet, because I'll be watching for the first time as part of this series his Fast and Furious contributions to the world of cinema, which I can't wait to do. But
so jealous of you.
It'll be the first time. I'll live tweet it. How about that?
You got to save that for us. I want the exclusive here. You know, you better not be telling anyone what you think about those movies.
All right, fair enough. Stylistically, what I liked about his, you know, his use of you know, the setups and the shots and everything like that was the fact that he was able to establish the characters in frame in such a way that you felt I almost go back to that George Lucas sort of thing, because there are a couple of different moments, like when they have the party and they're going through all of the different takes, and it feels like they had just sort of like an improv session going on, and he just said, okay, and go and do this, and okay, and now you have a shot of tequila, and what's it going to do? It has a very sort of documentarian feel to it, where it's like you're sitting there observing what's going on, but you're also like in it. And there are even the more dramatic moments where Ben, you know, is having a significant look toward whatever's going on or making a mental decision, where he constructs the scene. He constructs the visuals in such a way that you feel connected. Like what I suspect will probably carry through, although I don't know yet, into the Fast and Furious thing is that he is able to convey without the use of dialogue, which I guess would be another way to, you know, draw Lucas comparison there as well, is that the dialogue isn't the only driver for getting inside these characters' heads. And I think that he does a really good job of just establishing things so that even if they're not saying a word, you know what's going on in their head at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting for sure. And it is kind of going to be really cool to see these movies in sort of like a Fast and Furious progression. to see, you know, how his style changes as his budget increases or whatever. And I mean, going from a little movie about some high school kids to, you know, a spaceship full of people flying across the galaxy, boldly going where no one's gone before. So yeah, it's going to be fun for sure. I mean, we usually do this, you know, earlier in the show, but we haven't asked, or I haven't asked, like, what you guys actually thought about the movie. Are you a fan? What about you, Dennis?
Yeah, I was a big fan of it. I love this movie. In fact, I love the way it starts. You know, it starts with that great scene. I don't know, are we trying to avoid spoilers? Is that the plan?
No.
Okay. Well, it starts with this great scene of these two guys sunning themselves in the backyard, just like two guys would do when they have a day off here in Southern California. And then a phone's ringing, and they each check their pockets. No, it's not my phone. It's your phone. No, it's not my phone. And they're alone in the backyard, but there's this phone ringing. And then they realize, oh, it's in the pocket of the dead body we just buried in the backyard, and now we got to dig it up and get this phone. And that's like the best opening. And then from there, it goes back to show how they got there, you know, and how things came to that point. And when I see something like that, I'm in, you know, that grabs me, pulls me in, and then I'm perfectly fine with letting the story kind of unfold at a leisurely pace or take its time, because I know it's going to get someplace that's going to interest me. So that's, yeah, I loved it from beginning to end, and I even love the ending. That kind of it's a somewhat, and I know a lot of people aren't really happy with ambiguous endings, but in this case, I thought it was the best way to go.
I did like it as well. I did not see it when it was released, so this is my first time viewing it. I did enjoy it. I thought it was clever. Dennis, to speak to your point about the opening, I found there was sort of shades of Blue Velvet about that. Because, you know, when the guy has the heart attack on his lawn and it zooms in and you see the beetles scurrying, and it's like there's something beneath this exterior that you need to know about.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did like it overall. It plays like an origin story, to speak to your point about the ending. So I think that there's enough in it that's relatable yet quirky enough, and quirky is sort of that could be a dismissive word, but in this sense, he isn't afraid to let the story develop. I think, to speak to the earlier point about a commercial director, this doesn't follow the typical he's doing small time stuff. There feels like a real progression and an escalation as it goes along that feels natural, even though it goes to a very bad place. Like, it doesn't feel forced in any way. So, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't seen this when it first came out either. Like I was saying, you know, I had seen the Fast and the Furious movies, and I think that was pretty much all of the Justin Lin, which I had experienced up until he was announced as the director of Star Trek Beyond, at which point I was like, oh, my God, oh, my God. And I just binge watched all of his movies and, you know, all of his television episodes and all that stuff. And, you know, what I saw in this movie in particular was, like I was saying before, someone who, you know, definitely has a firm grasp on a visual style in particular. I mean, it's a movie, you know, like you know, you were saying, Dennis, which has a lot more going on in it than what you would typically find in a high school comedy, which it is a comedy to start. It turns and gets dark, and that is rather surprising. But, you know, it definitely does start off as a rather humorous, you know, movie. And, you know, I'm a sucker for high school movies in general, just because I always feel like high school is sort of like the perfect representation of society. You know, it's like a microcosm for the larger whole, you know, and I think that, you know, by putting society, by putting like a city's worth of people into like one building or one classroom, it allows you to tell stories which are very big in a very manageable way. So I've always been a big fan of high school movies, and I think that this one does a really good job of that, and, you know, certainly gets outside of what you would find in the normal, you know, high school film. I do think that visually speaking, he is top notch. I mean, we see this even from the beginning. I mean, everyone knows now that, you know, he's a visual stylist from, you know, things like Fast Five and Furious Six and all the rest of it. But you can see it here for sure. And, it, you know, I was watching it, you know, on my, you know, I got it in HD off of the iTunes, and I was watching it on like this, you know, big screen thing. And it looks really freaking good for something which, you know, was basically made for, you know, very little money. Oh, and yeah. It's very, very impressive. And, yeah, I mean, the performances, everything, you know, even as a writer, which Lin's not really known for, you know, it's definitely solid, like across the board. And, you know, yet not similar to a lot of the other things which we will be seeing in the coming weeks. He's a very versatile director, for sure. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of this movie. Definitely, definitely. Okay. One thing that we can talk about is the fact that there is a Star Trek collaborator in this mm-hmm. movie here, Sulu himself, star of the new Star Trek Excelsior television show coming to you January on CBS All Access.
Please
John
note
Cho.
that this is not a spoiler, but a prediction. We should sidestep everything and say that right now that you're not getting any special knowledge here.
I am not getting any special knowledge, but I have been beating this drum for the past 3 years, and at this point, if it doesn't happen, then I'm just going to be like, screw it, I'm out. No more Star Trek for me.
Oh, don't say that.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. If you tell me Nicholas Meyer is writing anything, I'm watching it. I don't care if it's Star Trek or if it's, you know.
A reboot of Lost in Space.
I would totally, oh man, don't even kid. I want to see that. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like the most amazing thing ever.
But would it keep the movie timeline intact? Or, well, anyway, questions for another day.
Regardless of any of that, yes, John Cho is in this movie. That's a long way of saying John Cho is in this movie. So it's pretty cool. It's weird. It seems like this happens a lot in Justin Lin's career where not even by design, he ends up making movies with people who he worked with in the past almost coincidentally. Like later on, next week we're going to see Annapolis, which features a couple of Fast and Furious actors who he would later work with in sequels years down the line that he had nothing to do with the casting on. And here is another case of that. His very first movie, for all practical purposes, features John Cho. And now, Star Trek Beyond, John Cho. It's pretty cool. I like when things like that happen. It makes me happy.
Yeah, it's nice.
What did you guys think of John Cho in this movie? Dennis?
Well, Cho's got an interesting role to play in this film. He's the not quite villain, or he's the not quite antagonist. He's kind of the antagonist to Ben, our main character, because he's dating the cheerleader that Ben has a crush on. And he's at first presented to be kind of a jerk. He's seen to be cheating on Stephanie, I believe is the cheerleader's name. But then as time goes on in the film, he turns out to be a rather sympathetic character. And Cho can handle all that quite credibly and does a very good job with his performance, as, of course, fans of his would never have any doubt.
Yeah, I think he handles it well. He, you know, and he handles his turn well. There's the scene that jumps out to me is where he sits down in the cafe and he's going to light the cigarette. And the waitress comes over and is like, you can't smoke in the cafe. And he's like, oh, like he does. He has just that scene stands out because there's a real sense of, you know, not menace, but like he's able to carry off this real weight to his words where, you know, you could see why somebody like Ben would be put off by him initially. Sure. Not just the cheerleader, you know, he's dating the cheerleader, but like, he feels like he has this sense of power over Ben, and he's aware of it, where it's like, I know what you're thinking right now, and I'm going to mess with you because of it. It's a good scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely good. It's kind of crazy when you start going back to, you know, this kind of time period, and especially these types of movies like high school or college, you know, movies. John Cho is always there, you know? He's in American Pie. He's in the Harold and Kumar and everything like that. He just shows mm-hmm. up in random places, you know, and you're watching movies and you're like, hey, there's John Cho. And here he is yet again. And yeah, I mean, he is an extremely good actor. I mean, it's no surprise that he keeps on getting work. And I can't wait to see him on CBS All Access next January. So, okay, there is one more character or actor and character who is extremely talented and who we will see again in the coming weeks, and that's the character of Han Solo, played by Sung Kang. Now, this is, to me, I mean, I don't know. I just love stuff like this. John, you'll have no idea, you know, what we're talking about here, but the no. character of Han. I mean, let's just get this, you know, right out there. I mean, is he the coolest person ever in the history of people? I'm pretty sure he is, right? I mean, there's that opening shot where he's like, you know, leaning against his car and he's got his cigarette and he like flicks it at them and everything, and that amazing, you know, track in to him, and it's just like, oh my God, this guy is like the epitome of cool, right? And it, even though the character himself, you know, you kind of think like, this guy's kind of a jerk, you know? I don't think I would like hanging out with him, but I would hang out with him because look at how cool he is. He really is like the coolest guy in the world, right? And to me, and Sung Kang is an amazing actor, you know, and to me it's no surprise that Justin Lin would want to work with him time and again. And the character is so cool that it's no surprise to me that he would want to bring him back in the Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift. And I love connections like this. I love it when movies which are completely unrelated and not even in terms of genre or subject matter or anything have some sort of common thread which connects them. I love the idea of Better Luck Tomorrow taking place in the Fast and the Furious universe, right? I mean, it's the Fast and the Furious expanded universe, really. The Fast and the Furious cinematic universe. I mean, they keep on talking about wanting to do spin-offs. It's like, here's the first one, right? And I love the idea of it's just like, it's a different genre. It's a different type of movie. And this character who worked really well in this story will also work extremely well in a completely different type of story. But yeah, I don't know. Well, Dennis, as someone who's seen the Fast and the Furious movies, what do you think about the inclusion of Han here and how that character is expanded in future installments? And no spoilers. No spoilers.
Okay. All right. Well, he's a fantastic actor. You've got that right. And he's really introduced well in Better Luck Tomorrow. I love how they introduce him as the complete polar opposite of Virgil, the kind of goofy screw-up. And then everything Virgil is not, that's Han. And he drives that very cool, it looks like a 65 or 66 Mustang, cherry red. Oh, it's just awesome. Just a fantastic car. And that really adds to his cool factor, driving a car like that. Although it probably doesn't run well, like most of those cars that still exist today. But that doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter at all. It could be breaking down by the side of the road and it doesn't hurt his cool factor at all. Now, in fact, that just gives him an excuse to lean on it and look cool like he, you know, and we know he's good at that. As far as his character perhaps being an expanded universe kind of character, that's kind of a fun idea. I don't know if I'd go that far because I think that the tone of these films, you know, of course, Better Luck Tomorrow is a far more realistic tone. That's why it's got the stakes are as high for these characters as they are, is because they do live in the real world and are very down to earth real world. You put these kind of petty crimes into a movie like Fast and the Furious, where they're stealing $1 billion every movie, and it's like a sneezing, you know, or the equivalent of not bothering to say Gesundheit or God bless you after somebody sneezes. But as far as picking an actor, what I loved is that of all the actors he could pick from Tokyo Drift, Justin Lin could pick to bring into the next Fast and Furious that he was going to do, he picked the right one. And it's not the lead actor. It's King. And that was the good, that was the smart choice there.
Definitely, definitely. John, and any thoughts on the character of Han as you see him now? I'll ask you again in a couple weeks.
The cool friend that you regret being friends with because his coolness hides a side of his personality that you don't dig. Mm-hmm. And I think to speak to your point about high school being a microcosm of the real world, we all encounter that at some point. But yeah, you know, I'm a good actor playing a very intriguing role.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, any final thoughts on Better Luck Tomorrow, Dennis?
Well, yeah, I did want to, there's one thing we haven't mentioned, and that's kind of the overall theme of the movie. And to me, that is kind of what you get in today's kind of American culture, where getting ahead or financial success is your only measure of success in life. You kind of end up with this overachieving, amoral kind of situation. Now, Ebert compared this to Enron, and I think he's that's a fantastic comparison, because the famous documentary about Enron was called The Smartest Guys in the Room, and yet they were some of the most corrupt executives in the history of corporate America. And these guys, these kids, they're the smartest kids in their high school, and yet look what happened to them. Without some kind of moral or ethical guidelines, they ended up on this kind of downward spiral of crime and violence, and even though they were straight A students. And I think that's an important lesson. And I love how they sneak that lesson into this kind of high school, what looks like a high school comedy, where you think about a movie that you mentioned earlier, American Pie. What's the lesson in American Pie? You know, what's the moral lesson there? And here's a movie that's a high school movie, 10 times cooler than American Pie, and yet has a much stronger moral lesson in it. So that's just my final thought there on Better Luck Tomorrow.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. Well said. And the only thing I could add to that is it's out there for rental, so go ahead and rent it. It's definitely worth watching. It really is.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think that this is kind of an amazing first film, in a sense, you know, and it really kind of sets the tone for the rest of Lin's career, as we'll be looking at in the coming months, I guess, sort of. It's kind of great to see what he can do on such a small scale, you know, and how effectively he can do it. So definitely check it out for sure. For sure. So, Dennis, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I'm on the Babel Conference, Trek FM's Facebook group for listeners. And they can find me on the network as the host of Continuing Mission, Trek FM's podcast about fan productions of all stripes. And my Twitter handle is at Dennis Castello.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And you're more than welcome back anytime.
Well, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun talking about this film.
All right. Well, that was fun talking to Dennis about Better Luck Tomorrow. But hey, breaking news here at the world, really. But creator news, big creator news for Star Trek. Star Trek 2017 has announced, as everyone I'm sure knows, that Nicholas Meyer has been hired as a writer / consulting producer on the new show. This is huge. And of course, if we're going to be talking about breaking Nicholas Meyer Star Trek news, which happens like once every, 25 years, we've got to bring on John Tenuto. So how's it going, John?
Hi, guys. Thanks. Very excited.
I'm very excited too. You know, I mean, I don't know what your reaction was when we saw it. We'll get to that. We'll get to what the two of you, how you reacted when you heard this news. But let me start by saying what my reaction to it. I saw it because on the Babel conference, Matthew Rushing posted the story from StarTrek.com. And I saw like StarTrek.com and I saw a picture of Nicholas Meyer and I saw Nicholas Meyer, Star Trek, and my initial like just sort of like instinctual response was, they got him to come to Vegas? All right. And then I read the headline and it's like writing the new, wait, is it March for April 1st? I forget, what's the date again? And I started reading it and I was like, oh my God, this is the most amazing news ever. That was my first reaction. My second reaction was, what does John Tenuto think about this news? What's his reaction to it? Because, I imagine that it was amazing. What was your reaction, John?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was speaking with my wife just a short time before then. We were actually preparing. We had a lecture we were giving for celebrating, you know, sort of remembering the life of Leonard Nimoy the next day. And we were doing our rehearsal of information and just memorizing and double checking and doing all that kind of stuff to prepare for Saturday's lecture. So I had the computer opened and, you know, of course, when my browser's open, it goes to the important news sites of StarTrek.com, right? So I opened it up, but we were really thinking a lot about Leonard Nimoy, you know, the day before the anniversary of his passing. And I had mentioned that, you know, while it was, you know, Friday last year, he came home and just a normal day, and then boom, the news hit about Leonard Nimoy, and it was this big, you know, obviously big emotional, horrible day. And here it is, a year later, almost to the day, and it's the Friday, come home from school, and boom. But this time, really great news, you know. So it was I had the same reaction you did, you know. I saw his picture, and I really, literally, my jaw hit the ground. The best description I heard it was, you know, as if Tolkien had decided to, you know, they had uncovered an additional chapter, you know, of the story or something, that we're going to get to see this again. I was very, very excited about it. And, you know, I immediately was happy and, you know, yelled out to my wife to come and see and just, you know, wanted to send my congratulations to Mr. Meyer and everything. It's just such great news, I think, for fans. Every bit of news that's been coming out about the new show has, I think, just been received really well, except, you know, the initial announcement that it was a sort of a paid thing. I think people were thrown for a little bit for that. But, you know, I didn't have a problem with that. I'm happy to pay for Star Trek, you know.
I mean, when you think about it, really, if they do like one of these a week, you know, it's $6 a month. That's like $1.50 per episode of Star Trek. I just spent like $17 on a ticket to see Batman versus Superman. So you know what? I can drop $1.50 for some Nicholas Meyer Star Trek. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think, you know, in some ways it's all in line with the way Star Trek has always been. Star Trek has always been. And I think you see that with Les Moonves had some comments today too about, you know, Netflix and Amazon and Hulu all wanting the new show, and that CBS could have just sort of sold it to them and walked away and took the check, and instead they really wanted to keep it within their world and to keep it, you know, what it is, which is this really great keystone, you know, franchise for them. You know, he really, you could tell in his comments how much he knew the value of Star Trek. And, you know, I think that they put it on CBS and that they're trying to use that as a way to get people to pay attention more to All Access as a shows a lot of confidence in Star Trek and its place. And, you know, the Star Trek's always been the thing that's been used when there's a new technology, in fact, it was Nicholas Meyer's Wrath of Khan that really ushered in the home video market of being able to purchase a film and keep it. That was the first film where they tested this lower price point and would people you know, buy a film for $29 to keep rather than just selling it for $100 to a video store and then you rent it. And, you know, I think the number was they had hoped to have 60,000 sales and they doubled that. And that really gave confidence to that market that people wanted to do that. You know, when laser discs came out and CED capacity discs came out, it was always Star Trek. You know, when Blu-ray came out, it was Star Trek. So this is just part of that tradition of, you know, Star Trek being used on the cutting edge. And, you know, that's where TV is all moving anyway. It's all going to be a la carte anyway. And yeah, I feel the same way you do. I have no problem, you know, helping keep the, you know, pay a little bit to help, you know, you pay for cable, right? I mean, there is no free TV anymore except, you know, whatever you can grab. If you have a digital antenna, you pay for it no matter what. So I'm thrilled. And I think that that's going to add to the quality of it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Well, what about you, John Mills? What did you think about the news?
Oh, I mean, I think the same as everybody else. Like I saw it on Twitter first, I think, and it was just sort of like I saw it and I was like I didn't process it at first. It was sort of like a shocked reaction, like Nicholas Meyer, really? And I went back into it, and it, you know, to speak to John, what you were saying, like this is Brian Fuller is somebody that the fans will know and embrace, and it's, you know, the hardcore fans of us are like, oh wow, it's Brian Fuller, he's coming back to the fold, this is great. But then when you say Nicholas Meyer, you don't associate him with TV production. You associate him with movie production. And so to speak to the value add of just having his name attached to it is, oh, they're getting, you know, this is going to be super high quality, you know, entertainment. They really care about this product. Like that's what it spoke to me first. And also the fact that I think that he's, you know, his rep is well earned as being somebody who can create a story that also has tremendous character development and intriguing characters in it. And, you know, also appreciates humor. I mean, all of his contributions to Star Trek have, you know, sort of helped shape that, you know, that classic humor that everybody likes about, you know, the entire series. And so, yeah, I mean, I you know, it's fantastic news. You know, I don't think that there's a single person that sees Nicholas Meyer's name attached to it now and is skeptical at this point. I think everybody understands that CBS really wants this to work well.
Yeah, he's sort of the Marlon Brando, you know, of writing, in the sense of, you know, the same sort of idea with Superman, right? How do you mm-hmm. Superman the movie? I remember seeing the trailer for that and people laughing at the very first trailer because the imagery was sort of the Batman 1960 show. And but then when you started, you know, you laughed when you saw the name. And then you see all these, you see these actors' names, and you start thinking, wait a second, they've got Glenn Ford, and they've got, you know, Marlon Brando, and they've got Gene Hackman. Wait a second. And it just elevated the perception of that film to have such high-quality people working on it. So I think, you know, I mean, because Nicholas Meyer really, he does have a long history, you know, in all different kinds of medium of storytelling, you know, whether it was novels or films or TV movies, and now more recently, a little more recently, into episodes. But, you know, I remember being a kid watching The Night That Panicked America, directed by Joseph Sargent, who did, you know, Corbomite Maneuver, and he did The Man from U.N.C.L.E. that Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner were in together. But it was written by, you know, the story was by, it was, the screenplay was co-written by Nicholas Meyer. And, you know, he did, of course, The Day After and as a director. And he did The Odyssey. And, you know, I don't think he was that happy with The Odyssey. But, I mean, in many times he was, you know, nominated for Emmys for his TV movies. So I think he's a storyteller across all these different mediums. And, you know, he's working on Crossing Lines. And I think he's doing that Medici miniseries that's coming out now, and he did Houdini last year. And so it's, you know, if he did a Fairy Tale Theater, you know, back in 1985 that he directed and wrote, you know, so he's dabbled in TV, and I think, you know, he may see himself as a storyteller, and the medium isn't necessarily secondary, but the medium, it can be in any medium. And so I think exactly what John said, he's going to bring with him all those talents that he has to tell a story And I think he understands the necessity of charm, that the characters have to have a sense of charm for Star Trek to work. I think that's why the original series, and really all the, you know, Voyager, whose characters, you know, if their characters are charming, then, you know, the science fiction aspect of it falls away and it becomes a human story. And he's really good at that. He understood, well, you know, when we all know, you know, when he comes into Star Trek, he's not a Star Trek fan, but he gets the characters because he gets the charm that these characters have in their interactions with each other. And so I'm very confident that this is going to be a show that isn't a technobabble show, but rather will really be a character-oriented show like the original series was.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I mean, I think one of the things kind of speaking to the medium, you know, and how this, you know, I think kind of what you were alluding to is that some people might have the perception that television, or that he might see television as beneath him or whatever. Some people might have that perception of him having that perception of, that's a big stretch. Anyway, I don't think that that's the case because, if you think about it, I mean, television has completely changed, you know, even since Star Trek was on TV. Now, television is really the place where, you know, the premier writers go to tell their stories, you know? So it does make sense in a lot of ways that he's been doing so much television in recent years in particular. And, you know, I mean, I guess what I'm kind of interested in, you know, and kind of like thinking about the dynamic is Nicholas Meyer has always sort of been the guy. Like whenever he comes into Star Trek, he's the guy, right? And now he's not the guy, he's a guy. You know, Brian Fuller is the guy. You know, he's going to be doing Brian Fuller's, you know, show. And I'm wondering how that's going to impact his writing or what we might see from him in that sense. I have a theory about it, but, well, you know, John, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, if you, you know, you had sent me that link for the article, the interview with him today, with Nicholas Meyer, and, you know, what role are you going to have? And he's saying, you know, I hope I get to write some episodes, you know. I think when people are coming in this early, I mean, who knows, right, how far along they are in the development of it. I know Brian Fuller had spoken years ago about wanting to do Star Trek, so he may have, wanted to come back to Star Trek and create another show. At the time of him doing even Pushing Daisies, he was, you know, talking about this, and I think even slightly before then. And, you know, he may have had an idea sort of germinating and formulating. So I don't know how sort of far along they were and what Alec Kurtzman's ideas were and all that. But I think when you bring that writing staff in the original, right, you get somebody like D.C. Fontana who really writes the pilot episode with Gene Roddenberry for Next Generation. And that writer can have an awful lot of effect in shaping the characters, even if they're not the creator of the characters. So I think Nicholas Meyer is good at stepping in to already established worlds. He's able to step into the world of Sherlock Holmes. He's able to step into the world of Star Trek when these things have already been established, and he's able to kind of find a place and a way of taking that. And as he says, fooling around with them or playing around with them and making them interesting and making them different. So, you know, knowing sort of Brian Fuller's creativity and just, you know, from, you know, we got a chance to see him in Las Vegas last year, just the fact that he's a really great guy, you know, just like a nice person who I think is going to be open to all these ideas. I think a lot of people are going to be able to have a kind of an input there. You know, in the same way that, like, maybe Lawrence Kasdan, I thought that was a good parallel that you were bringing in. Like, so here's the writer, but you've got J.J. Abrams, who's kind of the guy who's shepherding this, based on someone else's franchise, right? So Lucas is Roddenberry, and J.J. Abrams is Brian Fuller, and Lawrence Kasdan is Nicholas Meyer. And, you know, that worked out pretty good, you know, for Force Awakens. So I'm hopeful that everybody's going to have a voice, and Nicholas Meyer will have a larger voice because of who he is.
I think that it's kind of interesting. You know, I mean, we're seeing this a lot. Like, you know, you mentioned the Lawrence Kasdan thing, and then there's this. And, you know, another one which really kind of stood out to me when I heard this news was The X-Files, you know, which obviously just came back. And one of the really interesting things about that is that the entire writing staff was like, you know, they were legacy people. They were people who all worked on the original series in a big way. And basically the approach which was taken with that show was really kind of like, we're just going to let you do your thing. You come up with an idea, you write it, you direct it, and we're going to see some classic X-Files in, you know, the James Wong or the Glenn Morgan vein. You know, that's the theory. And, you know, the one that really stands out, of course, if you ask me, is the Darren Morgan episode, Darren Morgan being one of the most beloved X-Files writers, you know, of all time. And his episode really does feel the most kind of like self-contained Darren Morgan-ish, you know, episode of that show.
Just as the touchstone, the third episode of this recent six-episode run, correct?
Mulder and Scully meet the were-monster.
Yes, just wanted to make sure. But, you know, not everybody's going to know Morgan's name.
Fair. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry, yes, so. Yes. But my point with this is that, you know, I can definitely see a scenario in which Brian Fuller goes to Nicholas Meyer and says, you know what? What do you got? You got a good idea? Just you go off and write that, you know? And we'll put it on the air because it's going to be awesome. And hey, do you want to direct it?
Well, what's interesting is there was a snippet of an interview with Meyer that I read in, I think it was a Den of Geek article.
Yeah,
earlier today.
Yeah,
yeah, where he specifically mentioned that he and Fuller had discussed Star Trek VI.
Yes,
in passing, that it was a touchstone for the two of them.
Well, I can tell you the exact quote because I have it here saved as a screen cap on my phone. Not that I, you know, am obsessed with it or anything, but Nicholas Meyer said, "The one thing I can relate to you is that The Undiscovered Country, according to Brian, is a real sort of taking off point or touchstone for how I guess he's thinking about the direction of the new show. I don't want to be misquoted and I don't want to misquote him, but he's fond of that film. Let's put it that way." Now, that could mean a million and one things. But to me, the thing that obviously stands out is the thing which I've been talking about for the past, what is it, like 3 years now? And that's an Excelsior series starring John Cho? I mean, come on. Come on. We're so close. We're so close. And, oh, by the way, you know, who's the guy who put Sulu on the bridge of the Excelsior? It was Nicholas Meyer.
Indeed.
Now, John Tenuto, what do you think about that idea? Do you think that that is in the realm of possibility? And do you think that, well, I mean, is that something that you'd want to see?
Well, I would love to see an Excelsior show because I think you can, you know, that you can also bring along with that, you know, anything set in sort of that movie universe. Although, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be the movie universe, and I don't, you know, you're hearing these lines in the peripheral of all this that it's not directly connected to Star Trek Beyond. Now, that doesn't mean it's not set in that universe, but it may not be. But you could still use John Cho as young Sulu anyway, even if it's Prime Universe, right? It's just have him be the actor playing your young George Takei directly.
Yeah, if you want to completely confuse everyone.
Yeah, I mean, just really, yeah, you know, just really. But I, you know, I, the nice thing about that, though, is that it brings in opportunities, you know, if it's set in the prime universe, I mean, I'm sorry, in the alternate universe, then it does bring in possibilities of having some of those characters bleed over, at least occasionally, to that. I, you know, if I had to guess, I would imagine that they're going to go further. I mean, I, you know, I don't know. I'm only guessing, but I would think this kind of concept, this that you have heard a couple of times that it's different. So could different mean than post Voyager prime universe? That's a possibility. Could it mean 24th or 25th century, 26th century? You know, that's certainly a possibility too. You know, prime universe or alternate universe, we don't know. So I'd hate to hazard a guess, but I think anything's possible if it's thematic. I mean, if you think of, well, what could that mean about Star Trek VI? I was trying to think about that today. I don't think it's not going to be a starship show. I don't think it's going to be. I mean, one of my things was, well, does that mean it's going to be like a Klingon show? You know, is it good about the Klingons or something? And I don't think they would do that. You know, I mean, maybe they would. But, you know, I think it would likely have some of the trappings of that, so particularly when you look at some of the comments, you know, by Brian Fuller and Alec Kurtzman. I think it's going to have some of the same trappings and be a starship show and be about going out and exploring and seeing what the universe is like. You know, I would love to see the Excelsior. I don't know, you know, what the plans are, but it could be that it has to do with the concept of maybe it's set in that era, you know, yeah. And maybe it's set in that era of trying to figure out, you know, what it means in a post war period of time. So what is Starfleet directly after Star Trek VI? That might be an interesting question. You know, when you have this sort of detente between the Klingons and the Federation and what would that mean? And, you know, when your enemy now could become your friend and looks like they're moving that direction. So, I mean, that's certainly a period of time that stories have not really been told. So, you know, there's a lot of possibilities there. I was thinking when you're talking about the revisiting writers and bringing the behind the scenes people back. And one of the things about Star Trek is, you know, it's never really had an auteur that, and especially in the movie world, that where there's been a consistency across many, many films, right? I mean, the most we've ever gotten is the same director directing a movie twice out of the 13 films that we're going to have. And you get writers here, you get directors here. Some of them come back, some of them don't. And there's never been kind of a consistency across these films, and even within the TV shows, there was consistency with Berman, and, you know, particularly from the Next Generation era after the passing of Gene Roddenberry. But, you know, even Gene Roddenberry on the original show left after the third season, and Rick Berman didn't really take over until the fourth or fifth season of Next Generation. And so I think it's going to be really great if they keep this team together, you know, for a long period of time, and we get, wouldn't it be interesting for really the first time in Star Trek TV history to keep, a team together, and the same showrunners and that kind of thing through the whole thing. I mean, even Enterprise didn't get the same showrunners through, you know, and sometimes people would leave to go work on another Star Trek show, and, you know, I would think it'd be great to keep them together. And but thinking about that concept of who is writing and bringing back people. You know, we have an idea in sociology called the 20-year nostalgia cycle that my wife and I talk a lot about. We give talks on it, you know, and it's the 1970s was a lot about the 1950s, right? You get Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and, you know, those types of things, and Grease, and, you know, the 80s was a lot about the 60s. So you had Wonder Years and Star Trek came back and in the 80s, and, you know, you get a lot of, you know, films like Platoon and the Born on the 4th of July, revisiting the 1960s Vietnam War, and then the 90s are about the 70s with that 70s show, and Star Wars comes back, and we may be in one of those 20-year cycles. I mean, it's been, you know, it hasn't been 20 years since Star Trek has been canceled, but since there's been a show that really touched a very large audience of people, you know, we are certainly getting close to two decades when Next Generation is off the air. And that was really the last big superstar smash TV hit, that, not to denigrate DS9, which is, you know, in many ways probably one of the best written of the Star Trek shows. But, you know, it never touched as many people. It didn't have the audience numbers that Next Generation did, which was beating first run, you know, programming in syndication. And, you know, Enterprise, of course, you know, you would have 2, 3, 4 million people watching an episode, whereas Next Gen, you were getting, you know, 10 million people, 25 million people watching the episode with Leonard Nimoy. So this may be part of that 20-year sort of nostalgia wave. And maybe they'll ride a little bit more closer to the Next Gen world. You know, Brian Fuller is kind of a Voyager guy. So I don't know what, you know, where his... you know, his fandom has originated in the original show. So this, I think, can be a very interesting pastiche of maybe all the best of Star Trek with something new added into it. That's my long answer for that question.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. He has said that he thinks that DS9 is the best of the series. And one of the things that I kind of took away from, you know, Meyer saying that it's going to be different or whatever is that it's, I'm guessing it's going to be serialized, you know? That's my guess, you know what I mean? By what they mean by that, you know? But especially...
Well, you know, it's the difference between the arcs on TV, right? I mean, and there are arcs on television shows. Some choose a very long arc, and some, like The Flash or you know, Arrow or shows like that, do these one season arcs where, in essence, the show really gets rebooted every year, which may or may not be the best way to do TV in a way, because I think sometimes the characters suffer because there's very little consistency. The characters are what they need them to be for that season's arc. And you know, Deep Space Nine became serialized in a way, but even then it wasn't a full commitment to serialization. You know, it was sort of a half step into that world. And you know, the closest we've probably ever had is that one season arc on Enterprise, where you had an entire season that was dedicated to primarily to one story. But even that then sort of rebooted for the fourth season. So it will be very interesting to have a Star Trek show that has a sort of a 5-year pathway for these characters. And you know, that may be what they're planning. And I think that would be, you know, a really interesting change for Star Trek.
It certainly would be, yeah. You know, I mean, I think it's necessary. I think that it's something which, you know, given today's climate, it kind of has to be that. And I think that would be really cool. I mean, one of the things which I think is really interesting about this, and a lot of people have been talking about this, is the fact that they are, in a sense, kind of like assembling a team which is representative of all of Star Trek on the whole. You know, you've got Alex Kurtzman, who's coming right off of the JJ-verse movies. You know, he teams up with Brian Fuller, who was a writer during the, let's just say, Next Gen era, on Deep Space Nine and Voyager in particular. And then he brings in Nicholas Meyer, who, you know, was very much a part of TOS, or at least the TOS movies, you know, for what that's worth. And it really does feel like they're kind of getting representatives from each piece of the franchise in order to kind of put this show together and make something that I'm hoping all of the fans will appreciate, you know? I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see, you know, I mean, when you look at sort of, you know, most of Nicholas Meyer's stories tend to have a dimension of mystery to them. I mean, obviously he's, you know, we all know he's a Sherlock Holmes fan, but, you know, there's the, even his movies, you know, there's an element to some degree in that, or mystery, you know, Houdini is, you know, mystery. In a way, you know, and uncertainty, those types of themes. So, you know, Star Trek VI is a big Sherlock Holmes mystery in a way. And, you know, he's very good at that kind of thing. So I'd imagine that some of the stories are going to have that mystery element, which Star Trek has always had, you know, where many episodes are, you know, when Mary Jo, my wife, watches episodes where there are mysteries, she gets excited because it's like, oh, you know, cause and effect on Next Gen. Those are some of her favorites, where there's a mystery element to it, and neither the characters in the show nor the audience know, you know, what's going on, as opposed to sort of a, you know, alien contact kind of an episode. So, you know, when you look at what each of the writers brings to it, they bring to it a different strength, right? So you look at Alec Kurtzman has, you know, he did Hercules and did sort of the fun popcorn, you know, the kaboom and character together. You know, that's what he's kind of known for, how to bring in character, but yet you're going to have fun action sequences. I think Brian Fuller, it's a lot of character stuff. You know, you look at his Deep Space, he did two episodes of Deep Space Nine that he wrote, and you know, one of them is the brilliant one with Sisko, you know, and there's also the you know, the Voyager episodes that were, you know, sometimes a lot of times taking the characters out of their normal environment and putting them into something strange like Workforce, you know, where they were, where we were seeing them in a different way and in a different light. And, you know, and then of course, Nicholas Meyer, who brings this just, you know, this 45, 50 year career of being a storyteller in all these different mediums with them. So, I mean, this is a very, very strong writing team. You know, if they cast as good as they've written, we're you know, in terms of choosing the writers, I think we're in for a great show.
Yeah, I'm just going to put this out there because, you know, whatever. I could be completely wrong about this, but I've been connecting the dots and I'm fairly confident in this, okay? I think that Jesse Alexander is going to be part of the writing staff. He is a writer who's worked on things with both Kurtzman and Fuller in the past, including Heroes, Lost, Alias, and most recently Hannibal. And there was a random tweet by a random writer-producer in Hollywood to Brian Filler, which was very cryptic. It said something along the lines of, NM plus JA plus AC is a great staff, but it needs some boobies. And when I said, who is JA and AC, the tweet was immediately deleted. So, looking at the sort of Venn diagram of writers and who fits into categories and stuff, the only person who's a JA who seems to be at all associated with this thing is Jesse Alexander. So, hey, that's complete speculation on my part, but when it happens, you heard it here first. Not sure about the AC. There's a few people who could be the AC, but I think Jesse Alexander is going to be on staff. And the reason why I bring that up is because I think it's interesting that he's the first non-Trek person who is, you know, theoretically going to be involved with this thing. It suggests that, you know, it's not going to be just a reunion, you know, like the X-Files was, but there is going to be new blood, which I guess is to be expected no matter what. But I think it'll be kind of cool that, to, in addition to seeing, you know, all of these, you know, legacy people who we know and love, we are going to get to see, you know, even if Jesse Alexander is not on the staff, people who you know, haven't written for Star Trek before, who are going to get their shot at it. I think that that's exciting too, you know, seeing what other writers have to say about the franchise.
It would be interesting to see if they do take a, you know, it depends on how many episodes there are a season, you know, obviously how many writers they're going to need. Are we looking at this is a 13, you know, episode, you know, drop? Is it going to be dropped at one time? Is it going to be weekly? You know, how is this going to work? And is it going to be 20 episodes, you know, within a year period of time with some breaks? But whatever the structure is, it might be interesting to see if they're going to do the original series route, which really has not been done on any of the other Star Trek shows, where they go also to the world of science fiction and just pull people from the world of like short stories and novels and, you know, that sort of thing, and bring in this kind of eclectic, you know, mix of people. We get, you know, Harlan Ellison and those kinds of people who worked on the original show. You know, Theodore Sturgeon and so on. They weren't afraid to bring in science fiction writers. You know, Bradbury was asked to write for Star Trek, you know, that kind of thing. And so he never did, of course, but because I think he said something along the lines, there's too much confusion between me and Gene Roddenberry already. People think I'm him. And but I think it would be interesting to bring that in too, to have that element, you know, not all the time, but to have a script here and there that has that sort of outside voice to it. Or, you know, I don't think they're planning to do that either, but they could also follow Michael Piller's perspective and open Star Trek up too, because that's how they found, you know, Rene Echeverria and Ron Moore.
That's how they found Brian Fuller.
Yeah, through that open writing process. So, I mean, I don't know if Hollywood is just too different now and they don't want to go that route, or they just don't, you know, they don't have 26 episodes a season. I highly doubt that we're going to get 26 like you did with Next Generation, but, you know, so there might not be that need to derive that many scripts out. But there's all these possibilities of who else can be added. And because I would love for Nicholas Meyer to be really busy on the show, not only writing, but as you said, I mean, why wouldn't he direct some? And he's certainly, and he's directed TV, you know, many, many times before, including episodic television. So, you know, even on that Crossing Lines show, he's a producer on there for some of the episodes, in addition to a writer. So he's, you know, he's certainly willing to work in the field of television. I think in any field where you can tell a story, you know, I would, you know, I'd love to see him do. I know they talked about, I don't know if they've done it yet, or maybe it came out, the comic book version of his 7% solution. But yeah. I'd love to see him write a comic book, you know, just purely off of his own imagination, whether Star Trek or not, you know, just to his own universe, or do a Sherlock Holmes story in comic book form. I don't think he's worked in comics yet. But he certainly has, you know, worked in all those different mediums, and I'd love to see him direct some of these Star Treks too, because I think the muscles that he uses as a director with the actors obviously is different than just putting the word, because you could see the difference in sort of the direction in Star Trek 4 of his words versus Star Trek 6 and 2 of his words. And, you know, not that there's a bad difference between them, but there is a difference in the way that lines are carried. And I think there's a little more twinkle in the eye for Captain Kirk in Star Trek 2 and 6 than in 4, just because of the nature of who the director was. And, you know, that changes things, you know, that changes things.
For sure. It's going to be exciting. You know, I mean, who thought, you know, getting new Star Trek is great, but who thought that we'd be getting new Star Trek from Nicholas Meyer? It's certainly something to look forward to in the coming year. Well, John, thank you very much for joining us. Where can people find you? You got some talks going on in the near future, right?
Yeah, we've been really fortunate this year. Lots of chances to share a bunch of our new research. We just finished doing research on some of the, not necessarily always the most famous or the ones that people think of first, but occasionally a few of them, but on the guest stars of the original show. And we've been able to look at original drafts of scripts and story treatments, and so incredibly fortunate to have been able to send some questions to DC Fontana and get her take on things. And so we have a talk we're going to be doing at things like the Creation Convention, where we're going to be talking about some, you know, how did Sarek start? What was the original idea for that? The Romulan commander, the female Romulan commander, and what the original intention was, which is fascinating, by the way. The original script by DC Fontana is tremendously different in every way, shape, and form, including the inclusion of Sarek. I'll give you that. Sarek was in that script initially for the Enterprise incident. Yeah, lots of, I mean, totally different. I mean, everything was different. The whole thing was different. And so we're going to be able to share that and talk about Harry Mudd and where he came from. And we've got some really, really great pictures and rare pictures to show with that talk. And we just got a lot of great, you know, 50th anniversary talks coming up. We got stuff about collectibles and our newspaper talk about the history of Star Trek through newspapers. And so we have several talks a month going on. You know, they're always free at the libraries for people and free in the community, and or they're at the creation conventions. And we're really happy we get to go to Vulcan. We got invited to go to Vulcan, Alberta, Canada, believe it or not. And give some of our talks there. So that's going to be, we can say we've gone to Vulcan and people aren't going to look at me strange now.
Excellent.
Well, they'll still look at me strange, but so that's really, really fun. It's such a great treat to share the information. It's really a privilege to share the information, to get access to it, and to share it. And you know, that's what it's all about. We want to, you know, get you know, as much making of information about Star Trek out there that's right, or as right as we can think it is. And share it with people. And we got a real fun one we just started looking at. We have all these letters between fans and Gene Roddenberry.
Oh, wow.
We think it'll be very interesting to take a look at how he reacted to the fans back in the 1960s and 70s. So, and then also looking at his writings of his commentaries on the scripts. What did he think about Star Trek II and so on? And we're anxious to share that. So, yeah, if anybody's ever interested, they can just, if they can hit us up on Twitter at MJ Tenuto. It's MJTENUTO. On Twitter, and we can always send a list of talks. They're almost always local, in Illinois at local libraries and stuff. But occasionally, we're going to other places, and very excited to be with other fans. I mean, like Saturday when we did the Leonard Nimoy talk, it was very emotional. We were really a crowd of 60 people just celebrating him and laughing and occasionally crying, and it was great. And it was a chance to even share a little bit about, the COPD documentary film that his daughter is doing and to talk about his legacy. So, I mean, for us, it's really wonderful. And now with the new show coming out, and having such people in it that we admire so much, like Brian Fuller and of course, Nicholas Meyer, who just, he's to me, he's just a really talented, he's not only a talented man, he's really sort of just a nice man who cares deeply about art and people and telling good stories. And I think that will be a big boost to the new TV show. So I'm very excited about Star Trek Beyond. Also I'm very hopeful because Simon Pegg is, one of the co-writers, and I mean, this is just the best year in the world. I mean, I got Star Wars, I got Star Trek. What else do you want?
Nothing.
What else can you ask for?
Not much.
The only thing that would be better would be Batman and Superman in the same movie if that ever happened.
Right? I know.
Oh, that's just crazy. That's crazy. When would that ever happen? Come on.
That's never going to happen. That's like Nicholas Meyer writing Star Trek. It's not going to happen again.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, John. It was great, and it was great to get your perspective, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, it's been fun talking about Better Luck Tomorrow and Nicholas Meyer today, but that's not all we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
The Ready Room.
He's carrying in the lamb chop sock puppet saying, "She stayed at her post."
While Charlie Horse ran.
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey!
My last one, I think I might get a little bit of grief from you. Workforce, part one.
Oh my God.
I know. Hey, I did not make fun of Fairhaven.
That's because Fairhaven's good and Workforce is boring.
Oh, bite me.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
You come up with something stupid because of some joke that someone said and someone else said, and then all of a sudden you're doing a tournament of movies which J.J. Abrams produced to determine which one is the crappiest.
The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor, we start getting hints of Cap, we start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew, and we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
Visually, to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. Those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Treks.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game yes. of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzell would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzell's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other.
He's
so
just
I don't...
closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. He can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down and get it.
Okay. Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find us on iTunes. Also, leave us a review. We'll read it on the air. It'll be fun. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, the Windows Phone, or you can stream and download the MP3 from our website or grab the RSS link as well. One way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to purchase some stuff from our store. If you go to trek.fm, there's a link to the Promenade, which will take you to our Redbubble store where you can find all sorts of cool designs, most of them by Aaron Harvey. And they're really cool. You can get t-shirts, sweatshirts, bumper stickers, whatever you want. Another way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We do have a review from all the way up in Canada from Brandon, who says, 5 stars, very generous. The title, The Citizen Kane of Star Trek Celebrities Work Out of Star Trek. Podcasts, I'm assuming. I don't know. I can't see the whole thing. It says, Mike and John are an absolute joy to listen to. These fine gentlemen really know their film stuff and clearly have a passion for what they do. They poke fun at each other and what they are watching in a friendly way that is fun to listen to. Keep up the great work. P.S. The funny voice that you are to read this in is Helium. See, I would have read it in the Helium voice, but I didn't see that until the end of the message. So put your voice requests up front. I mean, I could go back and read the whole thing now in the Helium voice, but yeah, we'll save that for next week. Next week, we'll do it in the Helium voice. But thank you, Brandon. We really appreciate it. And we would appreciate it if other people left reviews for us on iTunes, because that really helps us out. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find the network on Twitter at trekfm. You can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. Or go to our website at trek.fm and click on the discussion tab on the menu bar. You can also find this show on Twitter at comtrackstars, or you can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com, Or you can find John on Twitter at KesselJunkie or me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor who helps us bring commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. Well, that takes care of our first part in our series on Justin Lin, and we will be back next week to discuss the second film in our series on Justin Lin, Annapolis.